Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRTLP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. You can find us online anytime you like at kdrt.org/Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan. Thanks for tuning in. Well, the jazz musician we're talking about this week, you've probably heard his music, and perhaps you even saw him perform in Davis. This musician, says my guest today, Derek Bang, is, quote, arguably far more famous and acknowledged now than he was 12 years ago, or even in his lifetime. And that's saying something, because he wasn't exactly obscure when he was alive. We're talking about Vince Guaraldi, known most for the classic songs he created for the Peanuts TV specials. And Derek is here because he, Derek, has just written a second edition of his book called Vince Guaraldi at the Piano. So why has Guaraldi's music grown more popular a half century after he died? We get the updated story today, plus learn about the newest release of Guaraldi's music. Derek is a frequent guest on Davisville, and in fact, he appeared on this show 12 years ago when the first edition of this book was published. Derek, thanks for appearing with us again today.
Thank you, Bill, for having me. Yeah, 12 years later.
Yeah. Well, and of course, we do the annual movie show, too, which
that's true,
about
but 4 months. Different topic.
That's right. Well, let's just jump right in. You know, musicians admire Guaraldi's music. Countless millions of people have sought it out, listened to it. What's the appeal?
You know, I love answering that question. I get it a lot, and I never get tired of answering that question. His touch, his style, his compositional approach, it's cheerful. I cannot listen to his music without smiling. And I know that's true of a lot of other people because other people have told me that. On top of which, he had the uncanny ability to write a tune that you would swear you've heard before, mm-hmm. even as you're hearing it for the first time.
Now, that's kind of the definition of a standard, isn't it?
Like, the oxymoron, an instant standard.
Yeah. But like his Christmas Time Is Here, the music that he wrote for the Christmas special, particularly.
Absolutely.
I think that fits that category. So the music has cheer, and that's not due to the association with Peanuts?
It's not necessarily. He came of age, so to speak, stylistically, just as the bossa nova craze was hitting the United States in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And that is also cheerful music, laid back, friendly, easygoing.
You know, I'm thinking that may say something about our times, that we're drawn to something cheerful.
Well, whatever it takes, right?
Is that what drew you to his music? I mean, you've spent years of your life writing about it.
Well, I mean, like everybody else, well, I shouldn't say everybody else, people in the Bay Area had known about Vince Guaraldi for at least 10 years before Charlie Brown Christmas debuted on December 9th, 1965. But that's when he came to my attention, because that was the first time I heard that music when I watched that show, which in itself, aside from the fact that I was already a Peanuts fan, was a special thing because that was a Thursday night and I wasn't allowed to watch TV on a school night. So this was an important exception. I remember the moment. It's one of those seminal moments in my lifetime. I was just so taken by the music. But the 60s were a much more innocent time for 10-year-olds. I had no idea that any such thing as a soundtrack album for a TV special existed. Mm-hmm. So it was at least a couple more years before I realized that it did exist. And of course, I bought it. And by then, Guaraldi had also released the first album he did for Warner Brothers, Oh Good Grief, which had sort of a more up-tempo, slightly electronic rearrangements of the most popular Peanuts themes. And that was it. I was hooked.
This reminds me of what I hear people talking about with the Beatles, you know, when the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan, and that a lot of people right then and there thought, I love this. So I think you're right. I think a lot of people had that experience. I think I probably did. I was a little younger than you, but hearing it, it somehow made an impact right from the start.
And of course, the difficult part was, if you rewatch that show, the end credits zip by so quickly. I didn't see his name the first time.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's not like you were watching on a VCR and I could rewind and freeze frame. You know, it's gone.
Yeah.
And the same thing was true the next time it was on. So it wasn't until I actually saw the album in a record store that I put his name to it.
You know, I want to mention you're going to be speaking about your book on July 11th at the Avid Reader in Davis, in the evening, I suppose.
Yeah, 6:30 to 7:30.
Okay. But Giraldi died in 1976. Why, you know, what's new? Why do a second edition?
The trouble with a book like this is that it becomes incomplete before the ink is dry. Within weeks of the original edition's publication back in 2012, I began hearing from sidemen that I hadn't been able to track down, or sidemen that I hadn't even known had worked with Giraldi, who found out about the book from a friend of a friend of a friend or whatever. And I also began hearing from regular folks who'd had wonderful Giraldi experiences. And some of those stories are just precious. I mean, one of my favorites is Peggy Tillman, who was a college student when Giraldi performed at Cotati Memorial Auditorium in 1965. And she was hired by a sociology professor. She was a photographer. She was one of three people in their AV department. She was the one who took pictures. A sociology professor wanted to do a study of the way people behave when they're listening to a music concert. So she was sent over to photograph the audience. Can you imagine somebody doing that today?
So she was to photograph the audience listening to Vince Giraldi.
Right, right, right. Well, she completed that assignment during the first set. And then during halftime and from then forward, was able to just start taking pictures of the band. She gave some of the photos to Giraldi. One of those pictures got passed on to one of his sidemen, who passed it on to me because she eventually found it either in my book or because I used it online and got in touch with me because I hadn't properly credited her. And, you know, we went back and forth because, of course, initially I was horrified, but she was very generous about it. And she says, oh, okay, so that's what happened. Well, yes, you know, anyway. So her Giraldi experience was before the concert even started. He and she were talking because he was a flirt. He loved young women.
Hopefully not in any bad way.
No. He found out that she'd had a bad experience when she attempted to take piano lessons. And so he said, well, that's terrible. Nobody should be afraid of playing the piano. And he sat her down and gave her an impromptu piano lesson for about 10, 15 minutes before they started to play. And she was terrified because she was afraid people would start coming into the theater and see her seated at the piano and to wonder what the heck was going on. I love that. And the way she told it was wonderful.
So that's one of the news stories.
That's one of the news stories. And okay. There are several like that.
Because, you know, when you were saying, you know, that new details come out, and I thought, well, of course, some of that would be corrections, basically, because something like a book will make a big splash. People will say, hey, you know, this wasn't that town. It was this town. But that's more than a correction. That's additional.
Oh, yeah, that's insight. Gold.
About 25% of your revised book is new. Are there some really important insights into his career or things like that that maybe you've learned now that you didn't know the first time around?
The best one, and this is another gold one. Somebody alerted me 6-7 years ago to a 45 single that was being sold on eBay featuring vocalist Ella Jamerson accompanied by the Vince Giraldi Trio. And I looked at this thing, and my immediate reaction was, what? Vince never recorded with a woman in his career. Well, wrong. He did this one time. I mean, he worked with all number of female vocalists.
Yeah, you write about that in your
book. But he never recorded with any of them. And so the way this happened, well, I shouldn't get ahead of myself. So I did what I had to do to get the single. Spent way too much money. Some other idiot was bidding on it also. And I read up on her, and I found out that she had been a member of a gospel/R&B female vocal group called the Apollos, who worked in the Bay Area. So I hit the internet and found out she lived in the Bay Area still. So I cold called her and found her at home. And she was delightful to talk to. And apparently what had happened was that Giraldi had seen her do some demos at Fantasy Galaxy and really liked her voice and said, you know, let's lay down a few tracks and make a single. So they did. So Ella Jamerson, who is still with us, by the way, because I had to get her permission to include this story in the new edition, the icing on the cake, or the most frustrating part of that story, is that they actually recorded three songs that day. And the third song was Ella Jamerson doing Cast Your Fate to the Wind. And it has never been released to this day.
Does it exist?
Yes. I know for a fact that Fantasy / Concord has it in their vaults. And they had the opportunity, in my humble opinion, when they just released an anniversary edition, two discs with all kinds of incredible bonus tracks of Jazz Impressions of Black Orpheus, which includes Cast Your Fate to the Wind. That was the moment. They should have dug that track out of the vaults, and they didn't do it. I don't know why.
Yeah, that was his first hit record. That was the one in 1962.
Yeah, the album came out in April 62, and so did the single. And neither the album nor the single began tracking on Billboard's charts until early 1963, almost a year later.
Yeah. And then it became a big hit, Cast Your Fate to the Wind.
A huge hit. Well, he won a Grammy for it.
Yeah. And it's that and his Christmas music, I would say, are some two of the songs that many people probably carry around in their head, because that's that the open to Cast Your Fate to the Wind is just very...
It's, oh, yes.
As we've been talking, you've been making references really just to Bay Area locations throughout the conversation, Cotati and Fantasy, Berkeley Label, Fantasy Studios. This actually I read, by the way, I just thought this was in your book, I thought it was a tremendous example of Crawley's talent, was recording Jazz Impressions for Black Orpheus. It's a 39-minute record. They recorded it in 4 hours at the KQED studio in San Francisco. So, well, that's a stunning display of talent, but the Bay Area really was his lab, wasn't it? I mean, that's where
absolutely.
He grew up here in the Bay Area, rather. He lived there and he played there.
Yeah,
played his heart out.
Bear in mind, by the way, yes, laying down an album in 4 hours is impressive, but you're talking about the trio, Monty Budwig on bass and Colin Bailey on drums, and the three of them had been performing 6 nights a week, 3 sets a night for months before they went into the studio to record that album. They were tight.
Well, and I was thinking about that because he did play all the time, even after he was famous and he didn't have to play clubs. He did because he loved it. And so I realized they had that skill, they had that swing, groove, you know, whatever the right word is there. Still, a 39-minute record that became a classic recorded in 4 hours, essentially live.
Yeah.
That's stunning.
It is. It is. I think, if I remember correctly, Colin Bailey said that he thought the sound check took longer than it did to actually lay down the tracks.
That's right. That's the source of it in your book. Is Now, you talked to a lot of these folks, right, originally. Many of them now are gone and you revise, but you know, you talked to a lot of his original...
That was one of the worst parts about the second edition, because when I hit the final chapter... I started talking about all of these people who have died in the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Many, it seems like 4 or 5 just in the last few.
Yeah.
And these were people who played with him in his trio. They weren't people who, you know, played with him once someplace.
But correct. Yeah.
Major side players. We're talking with Derek Bang, who has just put out a second edition of his book, Vince Guaraldi at the Piano, which I think is generally seen as the authority on Vince Guaraldi's music.
Well, it's pretty much the only one and has been now since 2012. So,
well, I remember you saying that.
Unless somebody steps up and wants to poke a fight, I'm going to continue to lay claim to it.
Well, and as you say, there's nothing else out there. And I know originally that was one of your motives for writing it, is that no one else was.
Right.
And you thought his music needed to be out there. But this is Davisville on KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California, KDRT.org. Again, the program is Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan. We're talking with Derek Bang, who lives in Davis and is an author. Talk about his style a little bit here. This is a detail from your book. It just fascinated me. You know, it describes Guaraldi's intensity when he was in the groove. You quote Bay Area music critic Ralph Gleason, who wrote, Vince is always pulling splinters from his fingers, driven in when he claws at the wooden baseboard behind the keys. What was he doing to get splinters from playing his piano?
Okay, Guaraldi had lousy technique from a classical piano teacher's standpoint. If you watch him play, he mashes.
With his hand?
With his hands. He mashes. He's shoving his fingers at the backboard. He's running his palms along, what do you call, the foreboard that's in front of the keys. And think about doing this when he's playing very aggressive runs on the piano. Factor in the fact that his bassist and drummer can bring their own instruments, but Vince is always going to be stuck with whatever the piano the club is providing. And in a lot of cases, they're not in very good shape. And when I say they're not in very good shape, that means that a lot of the wooden elements have been splintering.
Okay, so it's not like he was splintering it. It's just he played with intensity. The splinters were there.
Yeah.
But okay, but that's, you know, I'm not a piano player at all. But just the way you're describing it, mashing it, hands actually on the keys, I think of pianists as it's their fingers that are doing the hitting.
Sure, and that was the case with him too. But what I'm saying is he played with such intensity, and you can see this in clips of him performing, that his hands are sliding forward all the time. He's not holding them in that I guess I can call it a spider touch that is beloved by classical piano teachers, where, you know, you lift a finger and it goes, you know, straight up and down, and you're always holding your hand like a crab at all times, which always made my shoulders hunch, and I don't like it at all.
Well, that wasn't a problem for him, though, then.
No, he was much more relaxed than that.
And his style, right? His hands were small, and his fingers were stubby.
Yep. And he couldn't reach an octave.
And so, but that was part of the intensity of his play, right? The pace of it is that he would bounce around.
He could play an eighth or a ninth or a tenth or an 11th because he could leap from thumb and small finger so quickly that you'd swear he was hitting them simultaneously. That's, you know, if you're going to compensate for small hands, that's the way to do it.
So Vince Guaraldi died in February 1976.
Yes.
So nearly 50 years ago now. And so you didn't get a chance to see him?
I woulda, coulda, shoulda. I started going to UC Davis in 73. I knew he was there. I mean, I was enough of a fan at that point in time. But I didn't have a car. And I figured, you know, he's in his early 40s. There's no rush.
You know, he was just 48 when he died, and he played all the time in the Bay Area. So seeing him doesn't seem like it would have been much harder than seeing the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, you just sort of go there and take the time.
Right, right.
But you have talked to lots of people who played with him.
Oh, yes. Scores.
And so I'm wondering if there's like some general themes, things that they told you about him that came through.
Mostly that he was singularly focused on his music and his performance. I mean, that was it. And it's the fact that he got divorced suggests that
he wasn't spending a lot of time with other people.
Well, the fact that he was also conducting a very public affair undoubtedly didn't help. But his music came first. Also, and everybody mentioned this, he had a wicked sense of humor. He was quick with a quip. He was well-read. And God knows when he found time to be well-read, but he was. He could wax eloquent on a variety of subjects. He had a cute habit of making up funny names for people. When John Scott Trotter, an orchestrator and arranger, began overseeing the music for the Peanuts TV special studio sessions after the first couple of shows at Lee Mendelssohn's request, Guaraldi immediately nicknamed him Trotsky, although he was very careful never to call him that in his presence.
Let's talk about the peanut stuff. Because we've talked previously, and in fact, people can look it up. The shows are available, how Guaraldi connected with Charles Schulz, who drew the Peanuts comic strip, you know, to create the music for the specials. And these Peanut soundtracks are currently the main source of Guaraldi's new releases these days. I don't know if I have the trajectory correct here, but basically there was a deluxe of the Christmas special a few years ago, the Thanksgiving special soundtrack, the Halloween one, which is, I think, almost as famous as the Christmas one. The new one out right now, right, is July, the soundtrack for It Was a Short Summer, Charlie Brown, from 1969. Yes. Now, I got to admit, I never saw that one. And you're writing commentary on the songs for this release, I understand.
I am. Yeah, it's one of my new regular gigs. I love it.
How How was his music evolving by 69? This is like 4 years after the Christmas special.
Garaldi loved toys. He loved new toys. Lee Mendelssohn said that he was the first guy in San Francisco to buy a Moog synthesizer. As soon as electronic keyboards came out, Garaldi was all over them. Now, although he loved playing with them and was dragging them into clubs, until the early 70s, his scores for the Peanuts specials remained acoustic. And that's a good thing, because first-gen electronic keyboards were basically like playing an air horn. They were, you know, a note would be on until it was off, right?
That sounds attractive.
There was no shading. You know, there were people who could integrate the beep, beep, boop, boops, you know, better than others. And Garaldi was not very good at it initially. So that was one of the shifts. But he very quickly realized that it was kind of a dead end for him, because his strengths lay in the warmth that he could cajole from a standard acoustic piano. And by 72, 73, he had abandoned, well, he hadn't abandoned the electronic instruments, but in terms of performing in public and on the soundtracks, he went back to acoustic.
So does that mean the 69 soundtrack has some electronic?
No, it does not.
Okay. So if one likes the music in Christmas or Thanksgiving or...
Oh, yeah. And the other really nice thing was that by 69, he had already begun to build himself a library, his own personal library of connective character cues that became consistent from show to show, you know, Linus and Lucy being the most famous, of course. But there's a song called Peppermint Patty. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a song called Sally's Blues. Charlie Brown has several songs. Snoopy has The Red Baron and Joe Cool.
So he was really building something. I mean, he died of a heart attack. So, I mean, and he was only 48. So, but I mean, boy, as I listen to you, I'm thinking he was still really building and expanding and trying things and dropping things.
Well, this is something that popped up when I was doing the second edition, and I may mispronounce this phrase. He was undoubtedly the first composer to create a library of leitmotifs for individual characters in an animated TV series. You know, John Williams is the one who really became famous for that in the public mind, for all the themes that he wrote for the Star Wars films. And to this day, when, as the new Star Wars movies were coming out, you know, parts 7, 8, and 9, you know, when Luke's theme came on, the audience would go, ah.
Oh, so Garaldi was doing the same thing with the Peanuts characters.
Yeah, he was. Nobody else was doing that in the 60s.
So we have just a few minutes left. I do want to mention that he played a few times in Davis.
Oh, he did.
And when we talked in 2012, you had dug up a review in the California Aggie of his final concert at UC Davis in 1972. It's a baffling review. It's kind of fun to look at and in a way poke fun at, but it also brings up a point that you mention in the book, that you had said in the book that at certain times writing music for Charlie Brown was perceived as blatantly commercial act of a total square. And this was in addition to jazz sort of seeming passé by the early 70s. You know, a lot of the clubs in the Bay Area closed. People got enamored of different kinds of pop music.
Oh, hey, rock and roll killed jazz killed live jazz for about 2 decades.
So, I mean, is that just the old complaint that claims popular art can't be good art, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, was he square? Hell no. He was much too talented and innovative to be considered square. It is that old complaint, and I also think in many cases that it is pure, unadulterated jealousy. As Garaldi himself famously said, I didn't sell out, I bought in.
Well, I want to revisit that review in Davis just because it's too amusingly bad to ignore, you know, even if the writer was just echoing an attitude of the era and not really reviewing the music. I have an excerpt. Would you care to read it?
Oh, I'd love to. This is a direct quote, folks. I am not changing a syllable. And it is indicative of the entire piece. Not to be dismayed by the danger of not equaling the magnificence displayed in the first half, Garaldi mounted himself, the audience, and his piano to heights never before attained in the squalor of Death Valley or the main auditorium with his drummer boy and bass player. All in all, he attained the precision and cleanliness of a Santa screen, O.S., and with the sobriety of a beer ottle. There were no deaths upon exiting.
So that was in the California Aggie.
Do you think that writer might have been smoking something when he wrote those words?
Well, I looked it up. I had to look up Santascreen. Apparently, it was a sanitizing wipe. Possibly, it was a urinal deodorant.
Even better.
But you know, Derek, you were a student at UC Davis, and you wrote for the Aggies in the 70s. Explain your colleague's attitude here.
Well, I think in the early 70s, having gone back, because I went back and looked at a lot of very old issues, it strikes me that everybody working for the paper through the autumn of 1974 approached it as a joke. I mean, I started school there in the autumn of 73, and within weeks, I was already aware of the fact that everybody regarded the Aggie as birdcage liner.
So even the writers, in other words, you're saying this writer wasn't taking the paper seriously.
Nobody was taking the paper seriously. Nobody on the staff was taking the paper seriously. And then when I started my sophomore year, a bunch of serious journalists basically conducted a coup and took over the paper, and they brought me along with them. A lot of them had already become friends during my freshman year. And they reinvented the California Aggie. Within 1 year, turned it into a serious paper.
Yeah, that's an interesting side story here. Obviously, don't have time to interpret it today, but the lost Aggie coup of the mid-70s. Yeah. But
I don't know what went on behind the scenes. Yeah. You know, maybe they all quit anyway, and it just opened up the position. But why a significant group of serious journalists suddenly stepped forward at that moment, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, could have been Watergate.
Well, could have been.
It inspired a lot of people to look at journalism
You're
differently.
You're absolutely right.
So Giraldi died in between sets at a Menlo Park club. And this was just after completing recording of his final Peanuts composition.
It's Arbor Day, Charlie Brown.
Yeah. I mean, he's a force of nature. His star faded into the early 80s. You talk about this in the book. But he came back, and it's partly because other musicians revived interest in him.
David Benoit, I think, can take credit for it. He was recording on a fairly obscure little label. I don't even remember what it was. And so he does his fifth or his sixth album, and he decides to do an up-tempo, funkified version of Linus and Lucy, which nobody else had re-recorded up to that point in time. And it became a hit on radio. This was back in the days when it was still possible for a hit on radio to generate album sales. Well, for Benoit personally, suddenly he found himself courted by GRP Records, which was a major label at that point in time. And it also helped revive interest, ironically enough, in Giraldi himself. And of course, Benoit loves the fact that, for years, when you'd hear Linus and Lucy on the radio, it was his version. But that hasn't been true now for decades.
Yeah, because now the original music is back out. Yeah, we're kind of right at the end. There were other musicians who sort of followed in his wake. But the net effect, like George Winston.
Absolutely.
But the net effect then is that, it kind of reintroduced Giraldi, reminded people what they liked about the music.
When somebody like Wynton Marsalis says, the only time you heard jazz on television was when Charlie Brown came to town. You know you're dealing with a serious musician who has serious respect for a guy who has been dead for a long time.
In other words, not a square.
No.
All right. Well, as I say, new music continues to come out. This book is one of it. Derek is going to be speaking again, just mentioned at the Avid Reader in Davis on July 11th. Derek, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you, Bill. I love the questions, and I love the chatter.
Well, Giraldi is worth the effort.
Well, that is an understatement.
I'm Bill Buchanan. This is Davisville on KDRT 95.7 FM, Davis, California, KDRT.org online. Thank you for listening.